thank you very much. It's a pleasure to visit the Perimeter Institute. Hadn't been here before, so it's a pretty cool place. I like it. So I want to tell you a story today about symmetry and topology. So these are, of course, two of the conceptual pillars that we have for understanding physics and for understanding matter. Symmetry, of course, is about what you can do to a system that keeps it the same. Okay, and you can understand it's a very powerful idea in physics. And it's one of the first things we teach our physics students about the power of taking advantage of symmetry. And importantly, there's a very deep idea that you can use symmetry to distinguish phases of matter. Okay, so symmetry is a very a familiar idea to most physicists. A little bit less familiar is the idea of topology. And so what topology is about is it's about what is it that stays the same when you deform a system. Okay, and so you can imagine squishing an orange into the surface of a bowl, or you can imagine stretching a donut into a coffee cup. And there's something about those processes that stay the same, which is the number of holes. Okay, so topology, of course, is a very deep and beautiful branch of mathematics, but it also has many interesting applications in physics. And in particular, there's this beautiful idea that topology can be used to distinguish topological phases of matter. Okay, and so this idea of topology and phases of matter, of course, is something is an idea that we've celebrated this year with the Nobel Prize in Physics to David Thallus, Duncan Haldane, and Michael Kostelitz for their theoretical discoveries of topological phase transitions and topological phases of matter. And so, so it's really these ideas that underlie a lot of what is new and exciting about topological phases. Now, of course, this Nobel Prize was given for work that was done, decades ago. Okay, and so what is new in the last decade has been a deepening of our understanding of the interplay between symmetry and topology, and in particular with regards to electronic phases of matter. So that's the story that I want to tell you about today. And now it's going to be a little bit of a schizophrenic talk because the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through the story of basically topological electronic phases of matter, the quantum Hall effect, topological insulators, topological superconductors. And so this is, over the last decade, there's been a huge amount of both experimental and theoretical progress in our understanding of these phases of matter. But then after I have done that, I'm going to shift gears and talk about something which on the face of it looks completely different. Okay. In particular, a completely different set of class of problems which are based on classical mechanics. Okay, so no H-bar. Okay, but what I would like to argue to you is that the sort of mathematical framework that we use to understand topological quantum phases actually has parallels in this classical mechanics setting, and in particular the existence of topological boundary modes and the understanding that comes from this. And so so hopefully by the time I've explained this, you'll sort of see the connection between these two very different fields of matter. Okay, so I've been working on this area for the last decade or so. In particular, in the topological band theory, it all started off with a collaboration with Jean Mallee at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was joined by students, in particular Lang Fu. The last part here is something that that grew out of discussions with another colleague of mine at Penn, Tom Lubensky. And so the last part is really dedicated to Tom. Okay, so I'm going to start with the quantum electronic topological phases, and for that, the most basic phase of matter is the insulating phase of matter. Now, when we teach freshman physics, we teach our students about insulators, and what we tell them is an insulator you know, insulator can't conduct electricity because the electrons are bound to the atoms. They're stuck in place, and they can't get away. Okay, and so that's what an insulator is. Now, actually, this insulators are actually more interesting than that, because really it's a unique consequence of quantum mechanics that you can have an insulator. Okay, because it's quantum mechanics that in a atom quantizes the energy levels and gives rise to a energy gap that what has to be overcome in order for the electrons in an atom to do anything. Okay? Because, you know, the insulating state really, I mean, you might say it's the most boring state, because it's the state where the electrons don't do anything. They're just stuck in place. Okay? And they have to overcome a huge energy gap in order to get dislodged. Okay, so that's an insulator. Now, of course, a crystal of inert, atoms, maybe that is kind of boring, but things are more interesting if you make them closer together so that and make them interact with each other so they start forming covalent bonds. And so it was really one of the big triumphs of quantum mechanics in the last century was the development of the language for describing the electronic properties of such insulators. Okay, and so this language is called the band theory of solids, and basically in band theory one can understand the electronic states in a crystal which has a periodic translation symmetry, and one can understand the electronic states as a function of momentum, basically. And the thing which is the feature which remains in an insulator is that you continue to have an energy gap which separates the occupied electronic states in the valence band from the empty electronic states in the conduction band. And this is the existence of this energy gap which really is the essence of being an insulator. Now, band theory, I have to say, band theory is probably one of the most consequential theories in physics. Okay, so the understanding of the electronic structure of materials that we get from band theory really underlies all of the electronic technology that you have in your pocket. Okay, and so it's really one has a very detailed and complicated understanding of the details of the electronic structure, say of silicon, which allows one to harness, all of the amazing things that one can do with electrons in electronic materials. Okay, but there's a point that I want to make. Even though the electronic structure of silicon is kind of complicated, all these bands, there's a sense in which it's kind of the same as this trivial atomic insulator, in the following sense, that I can imagine smoothly deforming. Smoothly separating the atoms, making them get further and further apart, making the energy gap get bigger, and smoothly interpolating between this and this, and nothing drastic happens along the way. Okay, so there's a sense in which the covalent insulator is really kind of the same as the atomic insulator. Actually, it's actually kind of the same as the vacuum, because the vacuum isn't as empty as you first might think. So if you think in terms of relativistic quantum mechanics, Dirac's quantum mechanics, then the vacuum has an energy gap too. Okay, so the energy gap, the valence band of the vacuum has to do with the positron, the antiparticle of the electron. Okay, the only difference is that the energy gap is a million times bigger. Okay. So there's a sense in which all three of these are kind of the same, okay? In the sense of topology that one can imagine continuously deforming one into the other, and so there's a sense in which they're the same. And so I'd like to elevate this idea of this topological continuity, being able to smoothly deform things without closing the energy gap into a principle, and so basically try to argue that insulators are topologically equivalent if they can be smoothly deformed into one another and remain an insulator the whole time, okay, without closing the energy gap, okay? And so now, of course, most insulators are kind of the trivial. They're like a trivial atomic insulator, like the vacuum, okay? So the interesting question that this poses is, do there exist insulators that, so if the trivial insulator is like the sphere, is there an analog of the donut, okay? So are there topological phases that are not adiabatically connected to the trivial insulator? Okay, and so the remarkable answer to this, and so really, it's this, you know, this fact is one of the facts that we're celebrating with this year's Nobel Prize. The remarkable answer is that that actually there do exist topological phases. Okay, and there are fascinating states of matter. And so I want to sort of take you through a discussion of some of these topological phases. Now, the way I like to do these things, I always like to think about the simplest, stupidest example of a problem to try to understand, you know, what's going on. And the simplest version of a topological phase that I can think of is a one-dimensional topological phase. Okay, and so so I want to think about a one-dimensional polymer called polyacetylene. Okay, now polyacetylene is a conducting polymer. It has a rich history in physics. But what it is it's just a chain of atoms, a chain of carbon atoms with some hydrogen atoms attached, in such a way that if it has the perfect symmetry, there's basically one electron per site, and it basically forms a one-dimensional electrical conductor, okay, with a half-filled energy band. Now, but this is not what polyacetylene wants to do. Okay, what polyacetylene would rather do is it would rather dimerize. And by that I mean the pairs of atoms will sort of get a little bit closer together and make a stronger bond. So you alternate strong bond, weak bond, strong bond, weak bond. By doing that, what you effectively do is open up an energy gap and lower the energy of all of the occupied states and raise the energy of all the unoccupied states. So you can sort of see that this is going to be a lower energy configuration because you've lowered the energy of all of the occupied states. And so so actually polyacetylene is an insulator. Okay, it has a gap that separates the occupied electronic states from the empty electronic states. So everything's locked in place. In order for the electrons to do anything, they have to overcome this energy gap. Okay? But it's a kind of interesting insulator because there are two ways you can do it. Okay? You can either dimerize, you know, short, long, short, long, short, long, or you could dimerize long, short, long, short, long, short. Okay, and so there are two different insulating states. And so what I'd like to argue to you is that these two insulating states are actually topologically distinct in this sense that I said, that I can't get from one to the other by smoothly deforming without going through a point where it's undimerized. Okay, and when it's undimerized, then it's not an insulator. So the only way I can get from this to this is to close the energy gap. Okay, so in that sense, these two are topologically distinct. And so what we can say is that there are two topological phases which are separated by a topological quantum critical point, which is basically the undimerized point. Okay, and so. Now, in order to characterize the difference between these two phases, you know what, you know, when we had the, you know, spheres and the coffee cups and the donuts, you know, we characterized it by counting the number of holes, okay, and that's called the genus of a surface, okay, and so that integer is a topological invariant, okay, and so one would like to be able to topologically classify these. Now, I don't want to get into the mathematics of how one formulates this topological invariant, but let me say that that these two phases are distinguished by an integer topological invariant. And the way I can think about that integer topological invariant is it's a kind of winding number. You know, if you wrap a rubber band around a pole, it can wrap around zero times, one time, or two times, there is a winding number that sort of characterizes how the quantum state sort of wraps around in momentum space that distinguishes one phase from another, and it's an integer topological invariant. And so this integer topological invariant characterizes the valence band of this band structure. Okay. Now, there's a little star here. I always have a little star on this. So there's a caveat. Okay. And the caveat is that actually I'm making an assumption here, which is that there's an extra symmetry. Okay. And the symmetry is that in this simple description of polyacetylene, there's a symmetry, which is that the conduction band actually is sort of a mirror image of the valence band. Okay, every state in the conduction band has a state at exactly minus that energy. Okay, and so this is called a particle hole symmetry. Okay, now real polyacetylene actually doesn't have particle hole symmetry. Okay, a simple model of polyacetylene does have particle hole symmetry, and it's actually interesting to understand the consequences of that symmetry. Because I hope the theme that's going to come up here is understanding the interplay between symmetry and topology is a very productive thing to think about. Okay, and so if we have particle hole symmetry, then the band theory is characterized by this integer topological invariant. Now, okay, so you can say, okay, so what? What's the consequence of that? Now, the important consequence of this topological characterization of insulators is characterizing what happens on the boundary where the two different insulators meet. Okay, and so this is the idea of topological boundary modes. And so this is easiest to understand if I take a very extreme limit. Okay, so let's imagine I have the A phase, where I'm dimerized with one pattern, meeting the B phase, where I'm dimerizing with the other pattern. Okay, and let me imagine that the dimerization is so extreme that the strong bonds are very, very strong and the weak bonds are zero. Okay, so in that case, each of these strong bonds is going to have states that split by a huge amount. There's going to be a conduction band and a valence band with a huge energy gap. But this guy in the middle is going to be left behind. Okay, and it's not talking to anybody, so there's going to be a big gap, and there's going to be a state in the middle, which is just the state that lives on this. And it's going to be at zero energy. Okay, now, so this is a zero mode. Now, you might say, well, this zero mode being there is an artifact of this extreme limit that I considered. Okay, but now I can ask, well, what about let's relax that assumption. Let's start turning up the weak bonds, okay, and turning down the strong bonds, and ask what could happen. Okay, so here's where this particle hole symmetry actually is kind of interesting to think about. Okay, so we have particle hole symmetry, which says that this spectrum has to be mirror symmetric. Every state at positive energy has to have a partner at negative energy. Okay, and so what could happen to this zero mode? There's just one of them. Okay. So it can't move away from zero because then its partner would have to appear out of nowhere. Okay, it has to stay at zero. Even if I go away from this limit, this zero mode can't go away. It's topologically protected. Okay, and so in fact, this zero mode will appear at the boundary between the A and the B phases no matter how weak the dimerization is. As long as you have a gap on either side, then you'll have a zero mode where they meet. Okay, and so this is a big idea. Okay, and it's a very and it's an idea that has very interesting generalizations. And so I like to call this the bulk boundary correspondence, which is at the boundary between topologically insulating distinct insulating phases, there exist topologically protected low energy modes. Okay, and so this is an idea which has been discovered and rediscovered many, many times over the years, okay, and I think the first discovery of it was made by the field theorists, okay, and particularly Roman Jakiv, who were interested in certain one-dimensional field theories and recognized that you could have these topological modes in that, okay, and shortly after that, Bob Schrieffer was interested in polyacetylene. And he realized that the same thing was going on in polyacetylene. And sometime after that, I think that the two of them got together and realized that they were talking about the same thing. Okay, and so since then, this has shown up in many, many, many other contexts. And so what I want to show to you is I want to show you, the generalizations of this idea that that we now understand give rise to real topological phases of matter that can be, you know, studied in the laboratory, and one can has the potential for doing interesting things with them. Okay, and so that's the story I want to tell you. So the sort of mother of all of these topological states, and the one we understood first, and the one we understand best, is the quantum Hall effect, and particularly the integer quantum Hall effect. So let me tell you what that is. So the integer quantum Hall effect occurs when you have electrons which are confined to a two-dimensional plane, okay, and you put them in a strong perpendicular magnetic field. Now, you know what electrons like to do in a magnetic field? They go around in circles, right? That's what electrons do. They execute cyclotron motion. Kind of like the motion of electrons going around in an atom, right? Okay, and just like in an atom where quantum mechanics quantizes the electron motion going around in circles, well, quantum mechanics quantizes the cyclotron motion in exactly the same way and gives rise to discrete energy levels, and those levels are called lambda levels. Okay, and so the interesting thing is when you have some number of these lambda levels are occupied and then separated by an energy gap from all the unoccupied lambda levels. So it's just like an insulator. Okay, you have an energy gap separating the occupied states from the empty states, so it's electrically inert for the same reason that an insulator is electrically inert. Okay? The only thing is that it's not an insulator. Exactly, because you know what happens if you apply an electric field? So you have a crossed electric and magnetic field, and your cyclotron orbits, if I apply an electric field going this way, your cyclotron orbits are going to drift perpendicular to the magnetic field. And so that'll give you an electric current that flows perpendicular. It gives rise to the Hall effect. And in fact, this Hall effect gives rise miraculously to a Hall conductivity. So if you measure the electric current that flows in response to an electric field, then you find that it's described by a conductivity that is incredibly accurately quantized in units of E squared over H, where these are fundamental constants. Okay, and this quantization is, you know, you can measure it to one part in a billion. So there's something very deep going on with this, and so this integer in the integer quantum Hall effect. So this this was an experimental discovery. But then that got people thinking about why is it that it is so pristinely quantized, okay? And so it was really David Thallus, one of my heroes in physics, who really appreciated that this integer in the integer quantum Hall effect is really a topological invariant, okay? And so in this case, it's a topological invariant that characterizes a two-dimensional band structure. So we have electrons in two dimensions, and so it characterizes a two-dimensional sort of insulator. Okay, and so this integer has different names. So in physics we call it the TKNN invariant after Thallus and his collaborators. In mathematics it's called a Chern number. Okay, and so this is the consequence. Now I said what's interesting about these topological phases is what happens on the boundary, and so what happens on the boundary of the quantum Hall state, if you have an interface between a quantum Hall state which say has Chern number 1 and a vacuum which has Chern number 0, then there exists topologically protected modes on this on this boundary. And in the case of the quantum Hall effect, they're actually pretty interesting, okay? Because, you know, so you go around in circles inside your cyclotron motion. If you have a wall, then your electrons can bounce off the wall. And so they can go around in circles, and they bounce off and execute a kind of skipping motion like this. And the interesting thing about this skipping motion is that it always goes on this boundary from left to right. Only goes in one direction. So it's sort of like a one-way street for the electrons. Okay, they can only propagate one direction. Okay, and so these one-way electrons are very magical things. So if you solve this problem quantum mechanically, then what you find is that, in the bulk, there's a valence band and a conduction band, but on the edge, there's a band of states that connects them. Okay? And this band of states is sort of a one-way state. It has a positive group velocity, which is the slope of this line. Okay? So we give these states a fancy name. We call them one-dimensional chiral Dirac fermions. Okay? And these chiral Dirac fermions are magic things because if you're an electron, imagine you're an electron in one of these states, then you have no choice but to go forward. That's the only thing you can do. Okay, you can't turn around. So that means if you put in an electron over here, then you know with 100% certainty it's going to come out the other side. Okay, it has perfect transmission. Okay, and it's this perfect transmission of these edge states that's really at the root of how it is that you can measure this Hall conductivity to one part in a billion. Okay, so the transport in these chiral edge states is topologically protected, and that gives rise to this topologically quantized Hall conductivity. Okay, all right, so this is the quantum Hall effect. Now, for a long time, it was sort of believed that this was the only kind of topological state you could have. Okay, because, if the Chern number is equal to zero, then it's equal to zero, and it's trivial. Okay? But there's a thing about this, which is that in order to have this quantum Hall state, you actually need a big magnetic field. Okay, so you can ask the question: well, could anything happen if you don't have a magnetic field? Okay, now, if you don't have a magnetic field, this Chern number has to be equal to zero. Okay, but when you don't have a magnetic field, you have something else, which is you have a symmetry. Okay, and that symmetry is symmetry under the reversal of time. Okay, and what time reversal symmetry is about is whether or not if you take a motion picture and you run it backwards, the question is whether what you see in the backwards motion picture obeys the laws of physics or not. Okay, and so in a magnetic field, it violates it. Your cyclotron motion goes this way, and if you run it backwards, it goes the other way. So it changes. But if the magnetic field is zero, then you do have time reversal symmetry. Okay, and so the thing which is new over the last decade is the realization that when you have symmetries, then you get new topological states. Okay, so without the symmetry, when the Chern number is zero, then everything is trivial. But with the symmetry, there can be additional topological states. And so the simplest one of these, the one we stumbled on first, is sort of like the quantum Hall effect in that it's imagine I have in two dimensions, but now I'm going to imagine that I have time reversal symmetry. Okay, so the Chern number the is going to be zero. It's not going to be a quantum Hall state. It's going to be an insulator for that. Okay, but now what I can imagine though is I can imagine so now electrons have another thing, which is that they come in two flavors. There are electrons that are spin up and spin down. Okay, so electrons have spin a half. Okay, so I can imagine a state which is a quantum Hall state for the up spins, with one sign of the Chern number, and a quantum Hall state for the down spins with the opposite sign. Okay, now if I took that picture, and so it's going to have edge states, which are going in both directions for the up and down spins. Now, if I look at this in the motion picture and then run the motion picture backwards, it looks the same. Okay? Because when I run the motion picture backwards, the upspin turns into a downspin, right? Because it's sort of spinning the opposite direction. Okay? So then the edge states switch also. Okay? So this is invariant under time reversal. Okay? And so in fact, this is a topological insulator. And so it has counterpropagating edge states. And the important thing is that these edge states are actually protected by time reversal symmetry. So if you have time reversal symmetry, it's impossible to get rid of them. Okay? And this was sort of the first realization that there's something new that you can have when you have time reversal symmetry. And you know, there's a remarkable story. This is something where really it was the theory that sort of realized that this was possible. But in a very short order, within a year or two, there were proposals for where to look experimentally, and then experiments which looked there and found them. Okay, and so this was a quite a success story for theory motivating leading to a successful discovery of something new. Okay, so this is in two dimensions. You can also have a three-dimensional topological. You can ask, what if I have a three-dimensional crystal of stuff? Okay, could it have a topological band structure? Okay, and so there the interesting question is, well, is there something that could happen on the surface? Could you have a two-dimensional conducting state on a surface that would be topologically protected? And so that's what happens in a three-dimensional topological insulator. Again, you have an insulator on the interior, but on the surface you have a conducting state which has a very special structure. It has a what we call a single Dirac cone on the surface. And so this is something which, if you have time reversal symmetry, it's impossible to have that just by itself. Okay, but it can happen on the boundary. And again, this is a situation where we sort of realized theoretically that this was a possibility. And then it was realized what materials to look in. And then this is angle resolved photo emission spectroscopy data from Zahid Hassan, which really sees a textbook perfect Dirac cone on the surface. Okay, and so these are three-dimensional topological insulators, where again one has this conducting, these topological boundary modes, this conducting states on the surface. Okay, so I want to tell you one more example of a topological electronic phase before I shift gears, and so this. The final one I want to talk about is a topological superconductor. I don't want to go into too much detail into the theory of superconductivity, but let me just give you the key essence here, which is that a superconductor is actually kind of like an insulator, okay? In the following sense, that in the BCS model of superconductivity, which is basically like a mean field theory, okay, then one can describe the electronic structure of a superconductor in the same way that one describes the electronic structure of an insulator. It has a valence band, and it has a conduction band that are separated by an energy gap. Okay. So there's an energy gap to quasi-particle excitation. So you can sort of think of it, it's like an insulator, but there's a price you have to pay for this simple-minded insulator picture of a superconductor, which is that actually this insulator actually has an intrinsic symmetry, which relates the conduction band to the valence band. So this time, unlike polyacetylene, where it was kind of a fake symmetry, this is real, a real intrinsic symmetry. The conduction band and the valence band are really mirror images of each other. Okay, and moreover, the valence band is actually a redundant description of the same state. So an electron in the conduction band is exactly the same state as removing an electron from the valence band. Okay, so there's sort of a double counting of states in this simple-minded insulator picture of a superconductor. Okay, where these two states really are one and the same state. Okay, so that's, you have to keep that in mind. But once you realize that, then you can describe the superconductors in the same way we describe the band structure of insulators. Okay, and so then you can ask the question, well, we could have topological insulators which have some topological band structure. Could I have a topological superconductor that has a topological band structure for its excitations? Okay, and the simplest version of that is actually in one dimension. Okay, and so there, let's imagine we have a one-dimensional superconductor, has an energy gap, okay? Then you can ask, well, what happens on the boundary? Well, at the boundary, there might be, so you have an energy gap. There might be states that live within the energy gap, and then they have to decay exponentially into the interior. Okay? But the thing we know is that if there's a state at energy E, it has to have a partner at energy minus E. Okay, that's this intrinsic particle hole symmetry. Unless there's a state at exactly zero. Okay? And if there's a state at exactly zero, just like in the Sushri-Verheeger model, that this state is topologically protected. It can't go anywhere. Okay? And so the fact that you can conceive of this topologically protected zero mode at the end means there must be topological state. I mean, so how does it know whether it has a zero mode? It's a zero mode if it's on the boundary of a one-dimensional topological superconductor. So in fact, there are two classes of one-dimensional superconductors. There's the trivial and there's the topological. Okay, the topological has this zero mode on the end. Now, this zero mode is also a kind of magic thing, all right? Because, you know, I told you that we have this redundancy, that adding a particle at energy E is the same as removing a particle at energy minus E. Okay? So that means that adding a particle in this zero mode is the same as removing a particle. You get the same state. So that means that a particle is its own antiparticle. Okay, and so this is what we call a Majorana fermion, after a genius, Ettore Majorana, who realized that a consistent interpretation of Dirac's theory of relativistic quantum mechanics was that you could have spin a half particles that are their own antiparticle. Okay. So these are states which we very, very badly would like to make come to life in the real world. Okay. Now, and the motivation for why we very badly want to make these come to life is really something due to a modern day genius named Alexei Kateyev, who had the insight that if you could have these Majorana modes, then it gives you a way to, in principle, store and possibly manipulate quantum information in a way that is protected from local decoherence. Okay. So the idea is this: that if I have two of these Majorana modes, say which are at the two ends of this wire, they define a single qubit of quantum. It's a single two-level system, a single qubit of quantum information. So effectively, what this one-dimensional topological superconductor does is it takes a qubit. You know, and the problem with qubits is that it's very easy to measure them. And then if you measure them, you destroy the quantum information. But what this topological superconductor does is it takes a qubit and it splits it in half. And if you can only do local measurements at one end, it's impossible to measure the state of that qubit. Okay? And so what this effectively does is it makes the quantum information in that qubit immune from local sources of decoherence. Okay, and so in principle, this could be a way of storing quantum information. Okay, and possibly one can even come up with ways of manipulating quantum information, which is what you want to do if you want to make a quantum computer. Okay, now this is a tall order to make this happen. There's a lot of physics that needs to be understood and in order to be able to do this. There's been a lot of exciting progress over the last few years in this direction. I don't want to go into this in too much detail because I want to move on to the next half of my talk. But let me just say that I don't think we're in a position where we're ready to declare victory experimentally on the existence of these Majoranas, but I think it's looking pretty good. Okay, and there are various venues in which this can occur. One venue is using a topological insulator with some superconductors. One is using some semiconductor quantum wires sitting on some superconductors, and another is using a chains of atoms sitting on a superconductor. And at least in these latter two, there are encouraging experiments that see evidence for the existence of these Majorana modes at the end of the wire, which suggests that they are topological superconductors. Okay. Now, what has not been done is to demonstrate what it is about these Majorana modes that makes them so interesting. Okay. In particular, their capacity for storing or perhaps manipulating quantum information. So that has not been done yet. But that's one of the great challenges that we have in our field at the moment. Okay. So now, So I hope I've convinced you that there are many versions of this idea of having a topological bulk and a protected boundary mode, okay? So what I want to do now is I want to show you that this same idea shows up in a completely different setting, okay? So I want to go back before you know, Majorana, before Dirac, before quantum mechanics, back to Maxwell, okay? And so you know Maxwell. It's the same Maxwell as Maxwell's equations, okay? But he had lots of interests, and another interest that Maxwell had was you might call it structural engineering. So he posed the following question: so is a configuration of masses and springs is a frame, is it mechanically stable? Okay, and so imagine, you know, let's suppose you wanted to build a house. Okay, so you could build a house out of things like this. Now, but if you build a house like this, you might worry that that would happen. Okay, you know, and if that happened, then your house would fall down. Okay, and so what's going wrong here is that there's a degree of freedom that this configuration has that doesn't have any restoring force. Okay, and so that then makes your house fall down. Okay, and so what Maxwell did is he wanted to ask the question, well, what are the conditions for there being these floppy modes? And so what he recognized is that in order to know how many floppy modes you have, what you need to do is you need to count. So you need to count the number of degrees of freedom you have, which is basically going to be the number of masses you have times the dimensionality, okay? And then you need to compare that to the number of constraints that you have, which is the number of springs, say, number of bonds, okay? And if you don't have enough springs, then you're going to have floppy modes, okay? So a lower bound for the number of floppy modes is the difference between the number of degrees of freedom and the number of constraints. Okay. So now, of course, you know, if you're going to build a house, what you'd probably do is, you know, add some extra bonds to try to stiffen it up a little bit, okay? And if you did that, then you'd get rid of these floppy modes. Now, but one thing you know is that Maxwell's counting rule, I could add lots of extra springs, okay? So there's no reason that the right-hand side of this equation has to be positive, okay? So this can't be an equality, okay? So really it's an inequality. Okay? But you know, when you put these extra bonds in, there's a kind of a redundancy that you have. So there's something new that you get. Okay? And that new thing is something, so back in the 1970s, you know, engineers went back and were thinking, you know, they're interested in this kind of problem. You know, they want to make sure things don't fall down. And so they went back and reformulated this Maxwell counting rule as an equality instead of an inequality. Okay? And so the idea is that there's something new that you get when you build in these redundant bonds, and those are called states of self-stress. Because, you know, when you have these redundant bonds, what you can imagine is you can imagine putting the red springs under compression, and the red springs under tension, and the green springs under compression. So they're pushing in and pushing out in such a way that the forces all completely are balanced. Okay? And so this is a configuration of putting tension in the bonds, which doesn't lead to any net force. Okay? And so you need so what you need to do is you need to count the number of ways of doing that. Okay, and so counting the number of states of self-stress. And so what it was realized is that if you count the number of states of self-stress, then the difference between the number of floppy modes and the number of states of self-stress is actually equal to this difference between the number of degrees of freedom and the number of constraints. Okay, and so this is Maxwell counting rule, which is kind of interesting. So now the most interesting situation though is the situation where the right hand side of this is equal to zero, because that's going to be right on the borderline between being mechanically stable and mechanically unstable. Okay, and so what I want to think about, and this is something I was really introduced to by Tom Lubensky, is to think about a situation where the right-hand side of this Maxwell count is equal to zero, okay? And so that's going to be a situation where the number of bonds is exactly equal to the dimensionality times the number of sites, or that tells you about the coordination, the number of neighbors that you have, okay? And so, for instance, a square lattice satisfies that, okay? So the count is exactly balanced, okay? Likewise, the Kagame lattice, which is this lattice, has four neighbors, so it's exactly isostatic, okay? In three dimensions, you can consider the pyrochlore lattice, okay, which is basically corner-sharing tetrahedra, and that has six neighbors, which, again, in three dimensions is isostatic. So these kind of lattices are all, these isostatic lattices, and so the reason Tom Lubensky was interested in studying this is because these isostatic systems are sort of model systems for problems that he was interested in soft matter and statistical mechanics, model systems for problems where you're sort of on the verge of collapse. So this is a rigidity percolation, random closed packing and jamming, network glasses, or these various problems where this is sort of a simple model system to look at. Okay, and so so you can imagine looking at a model, and so Tom actually realized that something was interesting with this Kagame lattice model. Okay, and so let's look at this. So the Kagame lattice. So what I want to imagine, and this is a very simple-minded thing. I want to imagine I just have a bunch of masses and springs. Okay, on where the masses are sitting at the corners of the triangles, and the sides of the triangles are the springs. Okay, and then you can imagine you have a normal mode problem. You can figure out what the phonon modes are. Okay, now what you know is that if you have this lattice, there are going to be lots of floppy modes because you can sort of do this, and that's not going to lowest order. That's not going to have any restoring force. Okay, and so there are going to be lots of floppy modes. There are also going to be lots of states of self-stress because if I put it on. Let's do it on periodic boundary conditions, then I can tighten up all of these bonds, and therefore, the forces on all of the sites are going to cancel out, okay? And so every line of bonds has a state of self-stress, and every line here has a floppy mode, and so this count that the difference between the number of sites and bonds has to equal the difference between the number of floppy modes and the number of states of self-stress, it's satisfied. Okay, both sides are zero. Okay, now the thing that is interesting is what happens if you modify this. Okay, and so what Tom realized is that if you rotate the triangles, if you just twist it. Okay, so I'm going to take all of the downpointing triangles and rotate them clockwise, and all the up-pointing triangles and rotate them counterclockwise. Then that changes the problem completely. Okay, and so it's obvious that you get rid of all of the states of self-stress, right? Because now if I put these under a line under tension, then there's going to be a net resultant force. Okay, so it's not a state of self-stress anymore. Okay, and likewise, you get rid of the floppy modes. So that's fine. But the thing that's interesting is what happens when you don't do it on periodic boundary conditions, but you do it on a system with a boundary. Okay, and so if you look at this, you've gotten rid of all of the the floppy modes. But now what I want to do is I want to imagine that I have this twisted Kagame lattice on a strip with a boundary. Okay, and I'm going to nail down the sites on the top. Okay, and what I want to show you is that actually there are going to be zero frequency modes that are localized at this boundary. Okay, so you can solve this problem. So this is sort of a kind of a sophomore level normal mode problem. Okay, so you just have masses and springs. So you set up some matrix. So you want to look at your normal modes as a function of momentum in the x direction. Okay, so you can have wave e to the I kx in the x direction, and then you have set up some matrix that you have to diagonalize and find the normal modes. Okay, so that's a not a difficult problem. And so what you find when you do that is that so there are near k equals zero, there are sort of low frequency modes. These are like the acoustic phonons. So you sort of know that they have to be there, the low frequency phonons. But there's also a band of modes that is at zero here. And so these modes are localized at the boundary, and they're sort of, you know, going like this. Okay? Now actually, before Tom did the calculation, he knew that these modes had to be there. Okay? Because you see, if you imagine with the periodic system, with the periodic boundary conditions, you have this exact balance between the number of sites and the number of bonds. But when you cut it open, you remove a bunch of the bonds. Okay, so you've modified the count. Okay? And since we didn't have any floppy modes to get rid of, since we didn't have any states of self-stress to get rid of, when we cut the bonds, we had to add floppy modes. And the only way that, you know, and those floppy modes don't exist in the bulk because they're not there when we have the periodic boundary conditions. So the only place they can be is on the boundary. Okay? And so we knew that these had to be there. Okay? And so Tom understood that. But you know, the thing is that you look at these, you know, you can change the details, you can change the shape of the triangles, you can change things, and these zero modes, they can't go away. They're stuck there. It's as if they're topological. Okay. So Tom, he's, you know, been my colleague at the University of Pennsylvania for 25 years. You know, so I don't know, maybe some of you know him. He's like one of the founding fathers of the of soft condensed matter physics. So he's a serious guy. And we work in very different fields, but we talk to each other and we've written papers together occasionally over the years. And so I bump into him in the hallway and we enjoy talking about physics. And so a couple of years ago, I bumped him into the hallway and he said to me, you know, are my boundary modes related to your boundary modes? And so which my response was, no. You know, nothing like that, okay? But so Tom actually, he knew there was something there, okay? And so he was persistent, and he kept coming back. And so at some point, he came back to me, and we agreed to sit down and actually talk about it, you know, sit down and try to think about it seriously, okay? And so sort of prepare for that, I decided to come up with an argument to put this to rest, okay? And so the argument I came up with was I said, well, look, you know, what I'm doing when I'm doing topological band theory is I'm solving the Schrodinger equation, okay? So the Schrodinger equation is a first-order differential equation in time, okay? And the thing that's of interest is the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian, which, you know, are positive for the conduction band and negative for the valence band. Okay, and so what I'm all about is I'm all about topologically classifying the negative energy valence band states. Okay? So, but Tom, what he's doing, he's solving Newton's laws, F equals ma, right? So now, of course, Newton's law, there's second order in time. Okay, and now he has an eigenvalue problem too. He has, you know, there's a dynamical matrix that he's figuring out the eigenvalues of, but it's different because this, you know, this matrix is guaranteed to be positive definite. It only has positive eigenvalues. Okay, and you know, and the normal mode frequencies are going to be the square root of that. Okay, and so there's no valence band for phonons. All right, so I said, you know, these problems are completely different. How can we be doing topological band theory on this? Okay, so I said, no, they're completely different. But once I said it like that, then I was reminded of a story, which is this is one of my favorite pictures. So this is the legendary Solvay conference of 1927. Okay, so this is a conference that brought together, you know, the pioneers of quantum mechanics to, you know, debate that. And you know the thing about this picture to me is that, you know, there are plenty of faces in this lineup that you recognize, okay? But for me, at least, there were lots of faces in this lineup that I didn't recognize when I first looked at them. But then when I went and actually looked up who they were, I realized that I knew all of their names, because their names actually sort of live on, you know, because everything is named after them. Okay, so that's remarkable. But in any case, so at this meeting, one person who was there was the famous Niels Bohr, grandfather of quantum mechanics. Okay, and also a young and not quite so famous Paul Dirac. And so the story goes that during a coffee break, Niels Bohr runs into Dirac and asks him, "What are you up to? What are you doing?" And Dirac, who was notorious for being a man of very few words, replied, "I'm trying to take the square root of something." So you can imagine Bohr's reaction to that. You know, okay, let me know when you make some progress. But of course, now we know that the square root that Dirac was trying to take was probably the most consequential square root in the history of physics. Because the square root, Dirac was trying to take the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation to get the Dirac equation. Okay, and in doing so, not only did he discover that the microscopic origin of the spin of the electron, he also discovered that the electrons have a valence band too. Okay, by taking the square root, so you know, how do you take the square root of this? Well, you do it like that. Okay, and in doing so, what he recognized is that the theory has negative energy states, which are the valence band, okay, which give you the positron. Okay, so Dirac took a square root and got the valence band. So I thought to myself, if I could just take the square root of Tom's dynamical matrix, then maybe I could be like Dirac. So that was food for thought, and I realized that you can take the square root of the dynamical matrix, because actually it has a very special structure. Okay, so let's go back and think about what the structure of this elastic energy looks like. So really, you know, it's just balls and springs. It's very simple. So the energy is just 1/2 kx squared for each spring. Okay, but I need to write that the extension of the spring, I need to write that in terms of the displacements of the sites. And so there's a linear operator that relates the displacements of the sites to the extensions of the springs. Okay, and so then the energy, just the sum of all the 1/2 kx squareds, is going to be basically q times q transpose sitting between the u's. Okay, so it's almost a perfect. So this dynamical matrix is q transpose. So it's almost a perfect. It's not q squared. It's not exactly a perfect square. Okay. But it's QQ transpose, and so that makes another light bulb go off in your head, which is supersymmetry. Okay, this is precisely the structure of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Okay, because you know if you have an operator that is QQ transpose, it has a partner, which is Q transpose Q. Okay, and the miraculous thing is that if you look at the spectrum of these two operators, spectrum of eigenvalues of these two operators, they have exactly the same eigenvalues. Okay, except for the zero modes. Okay, the zero modes of D, well, those are the floppy modes. Those are the modes where I can do an extension without stretching any springs. Okay. On the other hand, the zero modes of d-twiddle, well, those are the states of self-stress. Those are the configurations where I can put the bonds under tension, but I don't get any net forces on the sites. Okay? And so in any case, so what this invites us to do is to make a matrix, kind of the way Dirac did, okay, and to combine these into a matrix that looks like this, and this is a perfect square. So this matrix is the square of this matrix, okay? And so what this means is that this allows me to turn Tom's problem into an effective quantum problem that has a Hamiltonian, that has a conduction band and a valence band, okay? And so once I did that, then I was able to turn that into a problem where I know what to do, because I understand how to do topological band theory. Okay? And so once we did that, then there's, you know, so then what you need to recognize is that this effect, this quantum Hamiltonian, it has some symmetries. Okay? So one symmetry is that everything is real. Okay? So it, you know, the Q is real. So it effectively has a time reversal symmetry. Okay? The other, it also has this Hamiltonian anti-commutes with, you know, tau z, you know, so there's an operator that anti-commutes with the Hamiltonian, which means that this this Hamiltonian has a particle hole symmetry. It's actually just the same as the particle hole symmetry in the Schriefer-Hieger model that I showed you. It's exactly the same. Okay, so that in the sort of lingo for, you know, for the aficionados, we give this symmetry class a name. It's class BD1. Okay, it's the same symmetry class that the Schriefer-Hieger model is in. And we understand the topological structure in that symmetry class. Okay, it turns out in one dimension there's an integer topological invariant that one can understand. Okay, and so by doing this, we were able to then go and think about topological phases of these masses and springs. And in order to get the different topological phases, we need to change the shape of the triangles. But it's still masses and springs on these on this lattice. And by doing so, one has some topological invariance, and one can cook up boundaries between different topological phases. And the boundaries between those topological phases have floppy modes bound to them on some boundaries, and on other boundaries, they have states of self-stress bound to them. Okay, and so these are topological boundary modes. Okay, so they're you know, you can change things, but these are guaranteed to be exactly floppy modes. Okay, now, but there's a thing, you know, which is, you know, so then of course we're trying to understand Tom's twisted Kagame lattice model. And if I go back and ask, well, what's the topological invariant in that case, then it's zero. Okay, it looks like it's the trivial case. Okay? But what we're interested in is the boundary, you know, but what I was trying to explain in the beginning was the fact that his model has these boundary modes on the boundary, on the edge, the physical edge of the system. Okay? And so we're not quite there yet by understanding these states, which are the boundaries between different values of the topological invariant. We need to think about how can we unify that with what happens on the complete edge. And so in order to do that, we need to sort of generalize things a little bit. And so this generalization really is a generalization of a famous theorem in mathematics called the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. And it's also a generalization of this Maxwell counting rule, okay, which really is kind of a baby version of the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. Okay? So the statement is that what we want, what the Maxwell counting rule does is it says in the global system, the global count of the difference between the number of floppy modes and states of self-stress is given by an index, which is equal to the difference between number of sites and bots. Okay? So the question that I want to refine that question, I want to ask what is the zero mode count in some finite subregion of a larger system? Okay? And so what we were able to prove is that there are actually two contributions to that. One is just counting the number of sites and bonds in that subregion. Okay? It's sort of a local count of how many there are. But there's another piece which is essential, which is depends only on the topological invariant characterizing on the boundary, okay? And so it's the sum of these two which explains why on the boundary between two topological invariants I have some zero mode count here, but I also have a zero mode count that lives on the physical edge of the system. Okay, and so it explains both of those. Okay, so by doing that, we were able to explain, you know, the zero mode counts and all these different configurations. I don't want to go through that. What I want to do is I want to show you one more thing because I'm already running a little bit late, and this is the last thing, which is kind of fun. So you know, I told you I always like to think of the simplest version of every problem. Okay, and you know, and the simplest version of topological band theory was this one-dimensional Sue-Schrieffer-Heeger, you know, polyacetylene example. Okay, and you know, I told you that this isostatic class system is the same symmetry class as the polyacetylene. So you can ask yourself the question: well, is there a mechanical analog of the polyacetylene problem? Okay, and so. So once I realized that this was a question to ask, then it was a very pleasurable evening sitting down and figuring out what that was. Okay, so let me show you what I came up with. So I want you to imagine a mechanical system, which I have a rigid bar, which then has bars that can rotate on it. So I have masses at these points, and these bars can rotate around. Okay, and then they're connected by springs like this. Okay, and so if you look at this, then you can see immediately that if I just move everything a little bit to the right, then to lowest order, that's not going to stretch the springs at all. Okay, I think you can see that. Okay, everything. So that's a low frequency floppy mode, and I want to argue that that is the analog of the undimerized polyacetylene, where I want to think of the A sublattice of the polyacetylene is basically describing the sites, and the B sublattice of the polyacetylene is describing the springs. Okay? Now, so the interesting thing is what happens if I tighten the springs a little bit so that it looks like this. Okay, so I've changed the length of the spring, so the equilibrium configuration now looks like this. And so again, this guy now is going to be completely locked. Okay, if I try to move this, there's no way I can move this guy without stretching this spring. Okay, likewise, this guy can't move without stretching this spring. Okay, this one can't move without stretching his spring, but this one can. Okay, you know, because you know it doesn't stretch a spring to do that. Okay, so this is the analog of the dimerized polyacetylene with a zero mode at the end. Okay. Now you might say that, well, this is just an artifact of these two being exactly parallel to each other. But actually, if I change the length a little bit more so that the equilibrium configuration is not perfectly parallel, then there's still a zero mode here, except that zero mode penetrates into the bulk. Okay, with some exponential decay. Like, you know, in this one, it was perfectly localized on the last site. It's as if this bond was equal to zero, okay? Whereas for this one, there's some exponential evanescent mode that goes into the bulk, okay? Now, likewise, if you have a domain wall between these two, then there's going to be a floppy mode. Now, the reason I wanted to show you this is because you know I'm a theorist, and so I you know sort of you know drew the picture of this and you know did a calculation and wrote a paper, but I was always dreaming to myself, you know, wouldn't it be nice to actually have a toy to actually play with that does this. Shouldn't be too hard to make, you know, but I never really got around to it. Fortunately, I have a friend, Vincenzo Vitelli, and so when he heard about this, he got very excited. And he got so excited, so he's a professor at the University of Leiden, he got so excited that he convinced his boss, so he's a theorist, but he convinced his boss to give him a lab that he has stocked full of Lego to make things like this. Okay, and so I visited Leiden, and he was generous enough to give me a version of this model. And so let me just finish up by showing you that. Okay, and so let me just back this up. So what this is. So this is just like that, okay? So the green bars, those are like the black bars. So they are completely rigid. The orange connectors are like the springs, Okay, so now the only difference between this model and what I've described to you here is that the orange bars are they're not springs, they're actually infinitely rigid. So it's like they're spring constants with an infinite, they're like springs with an infinite spring constant. Okay? So in any case, so what you can see is you know, this is everything's kind of locked in place. Can't move, so everything is rigid. But at the end, then there's your zero mode. So this is a very low-tech Majorana zero mode. Okay. It really is the same mathematical equations that give you this as give you the Majorana mode in a topological superconductor. Okay. Now, you know, actually, I'm kind of kicking myself for not making one of these, because actually, when they made this, Vincenzo was actually able to realize something that we didn't realize. You know, so we did all the analysis for very small. Small, sort of linearized analysis. But you can ask yourself, well, what happens if you keep pushing it? If you keep pushing it, then it goes down to the other end. It just keeps going. You know, it's almost like a particle, right? So there's actually some kind of interesting nonlinear physics that's contained in these mechanical systems as well. Okay, which sort of goes beyond the linear analysis that we talked about. Okay, so let me just finish this with the idea that this sort of mathematical framework of relating the topological bulk to the protected modes on a boundary. This is an idea that has many many different versions, many different applications that show up in widely different systems. Okay, and I think that there's many more opportunities to develop these things. So certainly in the electronic systems, new materials and experiments. In these mechanical metamaterial type things, one can imagine mechanical systems, optical. There's many other kinds of systems which are basically described by similar equations that one can ask whether similar topological phenomena can arise in. And I think an interesting further direction is to understand the roles of interactions and nonlinearities. Now, I think those are, once you turn on these, the similarity between these systems and these systems, I think, stops being so similar. Okay? So the interactions in the many-body system is not quite the same as nonlinearities in the mechanical systems, if you will. Okay, but both could give rise to interesting things. Certainly in the electronic things, which I'm more familiar with, we know there are many fascinating things with strong interactions. One could ask what kinds of things there could be with nonlinearities in the mechanical systems as well. Okay, so thank you very much.
Can you extend these topological notions to random mechanical systems like rigidity percolation?
Yeah. Well, so yes. So one example of that is so there are mechanical there's a version of the mechanical system that has a non-zero churn number. Okay. So for instance, there are some. So this is a little bit different than what I was talking about. But so there, you can imagine a mechanical system that breaks time reversal symmetry, that has a phononic band gap with a non-zero churn number, and then that has chiral edge states in that band gap. Okay, and so then you can ask what happens if you make that disordered. And you know, because of the quantum Hall effect, that it's going to survive, right? And so there actually have been people doing experiments and on that that sort of thing. Okay, so in these isostatic things, one can imagine doing something like that as well. And I know that we're guaranteed that it has to work. So if you think about a system like this, okay, where we have a zero mode at the end, okay, if I was to make it a little bit disordered, that zero mode can't go away. Okay, so we know it's going to be protected. And so there does exist a formulation of the topological invariant that characterizes, I used band theory, I used assumed periodicity to define the topological invariant, but there exists a formulation of that topological invariant that doesn't rely on the translation symmetry. Okay, and so for the quantum Hall effect, that version of the Chern number has been written down. Okay. I don't think it's been written down for this yet, but we know that it exists.
Is there a way of thinking about this boundary mode for the mechanical system?
Is there what?
Is there a way to think of the boundary mode for the mechanical system as kind of curing some sickness in the bulk, like happens in the topological space?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it's not an anomaly. I mean, there's no quantum mechanics.
But is there some analogy?
Yeah. The thing is that it's similar to the quantum system. What it's similar to is it's similar to the one-body description of the quantum system, not the many-body description of the quantum system. So it's really the single particle Schrodinger equation for the quantum system, which is the same as the wave equation for the mechanical system. Certainly I can't characterize it by saying there's some anomaly or something like that. That's not like that. So I'm not sure I can give you a satisfactory answer to that.
Okay, so if there are no further questions, I'll send the speaker again.
All right, thank you.